There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. He turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. This is the show about President Trump's legal issues, which are complicated. They bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and Twitter and whether you have to listen to a ruling if it comes from an Obama judge. It was clear we needed to devote some time every week to answering some of these big questions, so I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. Ken blogs about the law at popehat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So we've been talking a lot lately about the president's strategy of maximum objection to the congressional investigations into him, to not comply with things unless a court tells him that he has to. And one thing that you said to me a couple of weeks ago is that a strategy that's based on delay isn't likely to be as effective as some people might expect it to be. That while courts can be slow and often are slow, they're not that slow about these sorts of things where, like, someone serves you a subpoena and you say, well, I don't want to comply with the subpoena. And sure enough, we already have a ruling from federal judge Amit Mehta rejecting the president's argument that his accounting firm should be blocked from complying with a subpoena for the president's financial records. What did Judge Mehta say about why Congress should get to see the records that it wants from the president's accountants?
Well, Judge Mehta pointed out that there was really no law on the president's side. He went through a fairly detailed, lengthy analysis of the law underlying congressional power to investigate and talked about the history. He even opened with a quote from President Buchanan about the nefarious deeds of Congress investigating him. And what he pointed out is that the courts have always said that Congress's power to legislate necessarily involves a power to investigate, to gather facts necessary to make legislative decisions. And that power is very broad, and you can't just hand wave it away by saying, well, now they're doing law enforcement. He went through the president's legal arguments, which were slight, and basically demolished them, saying that the presumption is that Congress has a right to investigate things if there's any plausible theory on which it might lead to legislation. He cited the history of investigations of malfeasance by public officials leading to curative legislation and how that makes the investigations lawful and within Congress's power, and basically said there was nothing here that suggested this was outside of Congress's general power to gather information.
Isn't there also an idea about how this serves the impeachment function, that even without formally opening an impeachment inquiry, that Congress needs to have powers to investigate the conduct of the president before and in office, and indeed has used such powers in the past because it has a supervisory role over the president in the Constitution?
Yes, and not just the president, but other members of the executive branch. That's correct. But what was notable to me was it was clear that wasn't necessary. You did not have to show that it was going to impeachment or possible impeachment, that it could merely go towards a goal of good government and the review of what possible legislation that you might have to cure a problem. So, for instance, Congress could plausibly say that they are looking into whether going forward we should have a requirement that presidential candidates disclose their tax returns. And that would be a legitimate basis for Congress to ask for Trump's past tax returns.
The president has already appealed this decision. Should we assume that an appellate court will hear this case?
Oh, I think there's no doubt they will hear it, and I suspect that you'll see them handle it with dispatch the way that the trial court did. So as I said before, and as we see playing out here, when there are these big issues of these confrontations between two branches, so long as at least one of the branches is interested in pushing it fast, you tend to see unusually speedy reactions from the courts. I think we'll see a dramatically accelerated briefing schedule before the D.C. Circuit and a decision fairly fast.
And so why hear it at all? I mean, couldn't they just decline to hear the appeal?
No, they can't absolutely decline to hear it, because the way the trial court did it was to treat it as a summary judgment motion, and what is going to arise from it is, in effect, a final judgment, which is appealable. So they could handle it on a summary basis, basically just say affirmed or reversed without any sort of analysis. They could do it without oral argument, but they can't completely punt and refuse to review.
I see. But then the Supreme Court could decline to review it, though, because the president seems to be fond of talking about the idea that he's going to take these things all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yes, the Supreme Court could absolutely deny cert. And honestly, I think that's the most likely outcome, because it is really not a case that suggests that there are any hot button contested, seriously contested legal issues. And I don't think it's likely that the Supreme Court will see it as something that poses difficult legal questions.
And so then there's a lot of other related litigation out there that's going to involve the same sort of disputes and might turn to the same analyses, right? I mean, for example, you have the president also suing to block certain banks from turning over financial information, Deutsche Bank and Capital One. And then you also have this ongoing litigation over the issue of tax returns that Congress has sought from the IRS under legal authority that Congress has. The administration has come up with a sort of novel theory of why it doesn't have to comply with that. It seems like all these cases raise a lot of the same issues about what the Congress's investigative powers are and what rights the executive branch has to refuse to respond to investigations by Congress.
Absolutely. One of those matters relates to a specific statute that empowers Congress to request a tax return. Because it's under a particular statute, nominally it poses slightly different issues. But those issues could really be moot, because Congress can just request the same returns under its general investigative power that this court has now indicated is very broad. It's certainly possible, Josh, that some other judge will come to a different conclusion, but it would have to be a fairly radical departure from existing law, as I think Judge Maeda's opinion set out pretty well. Now, there's something that we're on this that we are getting the somewhat usual modern political and Twitter response to a legal situation. And that is that there is this triumphant announcement that somehow Merrick Garland who is going to be reviewing this decision. Merrick Garland, of course, being the D.C. Circuit judge who was nominated by President Barack Obama to take a seat in the Supreme Court and successfully blocked by Republicans for the remainder of Obama's term. People see this as some sort of rough justice that now he will be reviewing President Trump's case. That, of course, isn't right. He is a judge on the D.C. Circuit. That does not mean that he will review this case. The question of who will review this case won't be settled until it actually gets to the court and the judges are assigned by the processes that the court uses. It may or may not be him. He may or may not be one of the three judge panel that initially hears it.
But we should not assume that he will be personally involved in the hearing of this case.
Correct. If he is, it's sort of the luck of the draw. I think it's unlikely but possible. And it's the discussions on whether or not he ought to somehow recuse himself and not review it are even sillier than the suggestions that he's going to be the one casting the deciding vote. Generally, judges do not have to recuse themselves based on the identity of the president whose case is at issue.
So there are a number of these cases that are about document production and, you know, the president's financial records from his accountant, from his banks, his tax returns. Regarding the tax returns, there was a leak this week of a draft opinion from the Internal Revenue Service, which seemed to reject the theory that the White House has actually gone out there with. The White House has said, well, there's no valid legislative purpose for seeking these returns. That's why we're not producing them. This draft opinion, apparently from staff lawyers at the IRS, said, no, you can't do that. Maybe you could assert executive privilege over the tax returns and not produce them for that reason. But there's no authority in the law that allows you to just say, we don't think Congress is asking for these for a good reason. What do you make of the fact that this document made its way out into the public?
Well, this is clearly more what Trump would call deep state sabotage of his agenda. And it's not terribly surprising that there are internal documents and thoughts rejecting some of these very aggressive legal theories that the administration is using to resist inquiries into the administration and inquiries into Trump. So I've written memos like this, Josh, that later get rejected by people higher up the food chain and who decide they want to take a more aggressive legal stance on something. I think the memo likely reflects the correct legal view, but for now, Congress is still going to have to fight it out. And honestly, the memo is not going to have any real legal impact. It's not going to be treated by any judge as an admission by the IRS or anything like that. It will, however, have political impact. People will see it as an indication that this is a political assertion of privilege, not one that's well-founded in law.
I didn't understand the executive privilege idea. Executive privilege is ordinarily supposed to protect the confidentiality of advice the president receives from his internal advisors in the executive branch. Why would that have anything to do with his tax returns?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if you should think too hard about that because I'm not sure if there's any there. But to the extent that there is a theory, it may be that somehow to the extent Trump has amended his tax returns or done anything with the tax returns when he's been in office, and that reflects advice from people in the administration, that somehow would be executive privilege. But I mean, that sounds like nonsense to me. So don't think about it too hard because I don't think there's anything you're going to discover at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that if the White House thought that they had a strong case to go on that they couldn't produce the tax returns for executive privilege reasons, they would have asserted it because they were certainly looking for any reason they could come up with to assert why they didn't produce the tax returns. And they settled instead on this cockamamie theory about no valid legislative purpose by Congress, which again is not required by the law under which Congress seeks the production of these returns. So if that was such a good legal theory, I would think the White House would have at least given it a shot. There are also these issues of who has to testify before Congress. And former White House counsel Don McGahn was subpoenaed to appear before Congress and defied that subpoena this week. And so now we're looking at next steps on that. What can Congress do as it tries to enforce the subpoena and force the former White House counsel to appear? And again, we should note, we've talked about this a number of times over the last few weeks. McGahn might have good arguments about why there are specific questions that he either has a right not to answer or an obligation not to answer. But it sort of seems like he had to at least show up and assert that right not to answer rather than not showing up at all.
Right. Just saying that he's not showing up is an act of defiance that is more likely to provoke Congress into doing something. We have recently a White House assertion through the Office of Legal Counsel that he is allowed to refuse to answer questions. The validity of the arguments in that assertion are questionable, but he at least is relying on that and saying that he will not. So from here, it depends on what Congress has the political will to do. They can, as we've discussed before, assert a fairly ancient and not used inherent power to issue contempt, which would theoretically involve Congress using its own master at arms or something to go out to arrest him. I don't think that's going to happen. They can refer it to a U.S. Attorney's Office for contempt prosecution. I don't think that's going to happen because it's fairly pointless under a Trump administration that controls the U.S. Attorney's offices through the Justice Department. Or they can go to court. I think that's the most likely outcome, assuming, again, that the members of Congress in question have the political will to push that forward and want to pick that fight.
There is another person who some members of Congress really want to see testify in a congressional committee, and at least publicly, the administration's not been resisting the idea that he should testify, and that's Robert Mueller. The president has sometimes complained that Mueller shouldn't testify, but the administration has not taken steps to stop him from doing so. But it appears that Robert Mueller is not necessarily eager to testify, at least in public. We had reports this week about Mueller seeking to make a public opening statement, but then speak only in private with members of Congress. And this is surely disappointing for a lot of fans of this investigation. I think a lot of people have been assuming that this would end with Mueller spilling his guts in public. And partly that's about an expectation that, you know, he's the one who's finally going to take down the president and explain all of his bad deeds and how terrible they were. But another better reason to have expected that is that we know that Mueller wrote this sharply worded letter to Attorney General William Barr in March, in which he made clear that he was displeased with the way that Barr was handling the release of the report that he had put together. And so you might assume, doesn't Mueller want to get out there, set the record straight, explain what the report actually means, and maybe push back on some of the stuff that Attorney General Barr had said about that? And yet it seems he's not really so eager to do that.
He's not. And I don't think it's a big surprise to anyone who has followed the way he's done things throughout the special counsel investigation. The private letter to Attorney General Barr reflects Robert Mueller expressing his views through accepted channels in private in a way that doesn't publicize things and make them dramatic. It's sort of the opposite of the James Comey approach. And Mueller now is signaling, through in part statements made by people close to him, that he's reluctant to testify because he thinks it will be politicized, that he will become politicized and that the questions to him will be political, to which I think just about everyone who has been paying attention says, well, no shit, Bob. when did you figure that out? It's inevitable that any questioning of Robert Mueller is going to be political, that it's there's going to be a lot of posturing and base signaling and capering by the various members of Congress who ask him questions. And I'm a little skeptical that we're going to get anything particularly new or useful out of him. I think we're going to get, you know, sound bites at best. Again, he's as we've been saying from the very start of this, he's very much a rule follower. I'll buy the book type of G-man. I don't think he's going to use it as an opportunity to take shots, even if he has strong feelings about things. I don't think that you're going to get any big revelations out of him unless you've got someone who is very good at asking the questions. And I don't know how much hope there is of that.
Well, I think another thing is that there's one question that a lot of people are interested in the answer to that I think Mueller really doesn't want to give, because if he wanted to give it, he would have given it in the report, which is, would you have indicted the president if you were allowed to? And it seems to me that, you know, a lot of people are reading that into the report. If he wanted to say it explicitly, he would have said it already.
You know, I don't know that he would answer that question.
Right.
I'm trying to think what legal justification he would use for refusing. I think it might be something like the so-called law enforcement privilege or something like this. Or he might say, you know, I'm not able to answer a hypothetical like that, which is another popular evasion. I find it difficult to believe that Robert Mueller would answer a sort of what-if question like that.
I think it's worth considering the likelihood that Bill Barr has cured Robert Mueller's principal objections to the manner in which he handled the report, which is to say, you know, you had that March letter in which Mueller was clearly upset with what Bill Barr had said about the report in his own letter, what he thought was a misleading summary, or at least a summary that had led to people being misled about what was in the report. But then Bill Barr went and released the report substantially in full. And apparently over the objections of Rod Rosenstein, who wanted to release less of it. And so I think it's worth considering the possibility that Robert Mueller was very upset in March with the way that the report was being handled, but by the end of April was satisfied with what had been done with it.
Right. I think that initial somewhat angry Mueller letter reflects an uncertainty about what Barr was going to do. You have to remember in that moment, all of us were sitting there on the edge of our seats wondering, is Barr going to come up with some sort of justification not to release most of the report, despite him sending signals that he was going to release it? And I read in retrospect that Mueller letter as signaling that I really think you need to release more of this, and if this is going to be it, that's a real problem. But that problem to that extent went away when we got most of the report.
How is Bill Barr doing? How pleased are you with his performance as Attorney General?
So I'm not. This is something, as you know, that got me a lot of flack on Twitter and elsewhere for saying that, you know, he's doing worse than I thought he would, and people calling me an idiot for ever thinking he would do well. Josh, at first, Barr gave signs, I think, that he was independent enough, or at least steeped enough in Department of Justice culture and tradition, that he would be a somewhat effective barrier to some of Trump's worse inclinations. He signaled fairly early on he was going to release the report. He did release most of the report. He didn't assert a whole bunch of frivolous objections the way President Trump now is in litigation, and his redactions were relatively moderate. Since then, however, he has started to move in the direction of kind of playing the Trump political game. His press conference about the report when it came out was fairly blatantly partisan and mischaracterizing of the report. And his discussions and conduct relating to the Trump-driven investigation of Trump enemies, or to hear it from Trump's perspective, the abuse of investigative power in starting the investigation, have been very partisan and really almost to a Fox News level, echoing the president's particular feelings about it. So I'm unimpressed. I no longer see him as someone who is likely to be much of a barrier to Trump's inclinations. And I think that tendency is going to accelerate as we see this investigation of the investigators pick up speed and see more things happen with that.
When we come back, we will talk about Michael Avenatti, because we promised that to you. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Speaking of the production of substantially all of the Mueller report, some of the gaps in that are getting filled in, what little gaps there were in what we saw in the report. For one thing, despite this rhetoric about resisting everything that Congress tries to see in terms of further investigations of the president, the Justice Department actually reached a deal on Wednesday with the House Intelligence Committee to show them additional materials that the committee had subpoenaed, and it was heading for a big fight with the Justice Department over that subpoena. Essentially, the Intel Committee says it's entitled to see intelligence materials even if they originated with a grand jury, though of course they can't release the materials if they're classified. This had actually been a bipartisan request from Adam Schiff and Devin Nunes, who never seem to do anything on a bipartisan basis these days. Nunes did not sign off on the subpoena, but he did sign off on the more politely worded letter asking for the same documents that were sought in the subpoena. What do you make of the fact that the Justice Department is agreeing to hand over additional material to the Intelligence Committee?
I'm not sure whether it actually reflects some change in policy or simply strategically deciding which facts they're going to have a huge battle over, because they did explicitly in exchange for backing away from some sort of proceeding to compel, possibly even as far as trying to hold Attorney General Barr in contempt. So I think they're more picking their battles here. And it's possible that they think that whatever is behind those particular redactions is not particularly explosive. And a cynic might say that they expect that the things will be leaked and that then they can wave their hands and yell that Congress is untrustworthy and leaking national security information, and that's why we shouldn't send them more things.
There are also additional materials pertaining to Michael Flynn that we're likely to see publicly soon. There had been a number of redacted discussions of Michael Flynn in the Mueller report. Flynn, of course, has pleaded guilty, and there's been this ongoing, you know, sort of stalled prosecution as they wait to see whether, you know, what the extent of his cooperation was with the special counsel and whether Flynn should get a non-custodial sentence because he was fairly helpful to the investigators. Anyway, the judge who's overseeing that is ordering that some of those sections of the report be produced to him so he can make them public. He's also going to release the transcript of a voicemail from one of the president's then lawyers, John Dowd, in which he seemed to be trying to dissuade Flynn from cooperating with the prosecution. What do you think we're going to see in these documents?
Well, I do think we're going to see this call in this transcript. The judge's order suggests that he was somewhat outraged at the existence of this call and wants to see more about it and wants it to be public. It's not terribly usual for a federal judge to say, not only do I want this and want you to turn it over to the defense, I want you to make it public on the public docket. And that to me signals that the judge thinks that whatever is in there is fairly outrageous. Remember, Josh, that this comes in a context where the judge previously had absolutely blasted General Flynn for coming to his sentencing saying, basically, I'm the victim here of investigator misconduct. That played very badly. Flynn took what would have been an easy non-custodial sentence situation and put himself in risk of federal prison, and now was trying to earn his way back. So I think what we're going to see here is that he is going to get the non-custodial sentence he hoped for, but in the process, he is going to have to dump more on the Trump people who were trying to pressure him. And that this call may be one of several revelations this week and this month that is going to make some of Trump's lawyers look as if they are helping to obstruct justice.
Well, so the other thing you're referring to there is this apparent claim from Michael Cohen that Trump attorney Jay Sekulow had asked him to lie about when the president had stopped working on a potential project for a Trump Tower Moscow.
Yes. So this also came out this week that Cohen had made this claim that Trump's attorney Jay Sekulow had suggested to him that he had to tell this lie about when the Trump and Russia contact ended, which, of course, was one of the things that Cohen pled guilty to lying about. And it's been speculated for some time who knew about the lie, who contributed to it, who helped craft it. Now, the issue here, of course, is as far as we know so far, that's based only on Michael Cohen's own word. And Cohen is a admitted convicted liar, which very likely is what made him appealing to President Trump for a long period of time. But now very much there is a hunt on for corroborating evidence, because that's, as a prosecutor, that's what you always do when you have someone like Michael Cohen. You don't want to rely on him because he's terribly unappealing and incredible. You want to find things that show that in this particular instance, he's telling the truth. So the hunt is on, I think, for emails or recorded calls or whatever else that might prove that what Cohen is saying here is true.
But so the thing I keep going back to is, you know, Mueller brought a lot of prosecutions already over process crimes and, you know, lying to federal investigators and that sort of thing. And so if the idea here is that by looking at these materials, we can find evidence of obstruction of justice by people who aren't the president, perhaps by people who were working as attorneys for the president, if that was such a rich vein, wouldn't Mueller have brought those indictments himself?
Yes, based on what he knew at the time. So Mueller clearly was not willing just to leave this as an open-ended investigation to keep going forever until he wrapped up all the loose ends. And clearly he thought he did not have enough corroborating evidence to charge any of Trump's attorneys in connection with Cohen's congressional testimony. And in fact, that's fairly explicit from the report. But that's not to say that it can't still be developed. There are a few reasons for that. One is that things keep shaking out as big, dramatic public revelations happen. It naturally moves people to reveal things they hadn't revealed before. It brings new witnesses out. It's kind of, you know, the crowdsourcing of prosecution. So it is entirely possible that this will bring out something or someone that Mueller didn't see, or at the very least, that it will lead into a congressional inquiry into what happened and very likely a congressional accusation that Trump's lawyers were acting knowingly on the president's behalf in directing some sort of perjury before Congress.
Finally, we finished our UnDrive pledge drive at KCRW. This is where we asked you to become a member of the station to support production of All the President's Lawyers and other great programming from KCRW. And the drive was very successful. Many, many of you became supporting members of KCRW. Well, more than 100 of you. We're going to keep our word. We're going to answer some of the questions that we promised we would answer. So first, Ken, did the president do the RICO?
Maybe.
Maybe. Really?
Yeah, well,
I thought it was never RICO.
It's almost never RICO, Josh. I think that it is hypothetically possible that eventually the conduct of the Trump Organization and the Trump Foundation could down the line be demonstrated to be a colorable RICO case. I don't think it's likely, but, you know, you see real criminal RICO prosecutions out there, and those are real RICO. It's almost never RICO, but, you know, I don't think people should give up hope.
What about like some light civil RICO?
Yeah, light civil RICO, it's almost never civil RICO. I'm more confident saying it's not civil RICO than it is criminal RICO, in part because judges hate civil RICO, and anything a judge doesn't like, you're likely not to get away with.
Finally, is Michael Avenatti a good lawyer?
No.
That's it? The answer was just no after all this time?
Well, here's the thing, Josh. The essential quality of being a good lawyer is doing service to clients. Lawyers are here to serve clients, not to serve themselves. And if these allegations about Michael Avenatti are true, they show that he deliberately, repeatedly, and very dramatically violated his trust with his clients and defrauded clients. And that inherently makes him a bad lawyer. However skillful he has been in court or in papers, however bold he was to defy and eventually partially defeat the President of the United States and his fixer, Michael Cohen, someone who defrauds clients is not by definition a good lawyer, however skillful. It's like a surgeon. You know, you could say a surgeon makes the most beautiful stitches and the most perfect cuts and the most imaginative surgical moves ever, but if they ignore the patient and he or she dies on the table, they're not a good surgeon. Michael Avenatti, if he did the things he's accused of, is a bad lawyer, a criminous lawyer, and should go to federal prison. Josh, I'm willing to make a wager with you that Michael Avenatti will spend more time in federal prison than Paul Manafort.
I'm not taking the other side of that bet. That sounds entirely correct to me. There is much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW and also on Facebook. And thank you to everyone who became a member of KCRW in support of the show. It means a great deal to us. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.